Okay, good morning everybody. Baiho 241, and it's Tuesday, May 14th, and we're in chapter 14, cardiac output, blood flow, and blood pressure. Probably won't finish it today. Maybe we can finish it today, but probably not. Okay, and I mentioned last time what chapters will be on the test. I don't remember what I said, but review your notes. Okay, for what I said, because I have the chapter numbers here, and I would have to look up what the chapters are. I don't know them by number. Oh, yeah, 13 is going to wrap around into this last one. 13, 14, 16, 17, and a little bit of 20. Yeah, that exam figure. Right. That's also an extra credit in lab as well. Okay, so we're talking about cardiac output last time. I'm sure you've dealt with that in lab as well. Okay, so we have cardiac output. Remember, that's a flow. That's blood flow. And how do we measure blood flow? Is it distance per time? No. What's the dimension? It is volume per time, right? So like in milliliters per minute, that would be a flow of blood. Okay, and then here's just a little straight fact. Floating around 5.5 liters of blood is your total blood volume. I think that's kind of handy just to keep on the tip of your tongue that you should know that. Okay, you all know that without neuronal influences, the heart will beat on its own because of the sinoatrial node. Right, the sinoatrial node depolarizes spontaneously at a particular rhythm. Right, and that particular rhythm can be adjusted by the parasympathetic or sympathetic nervous system, but it doesn't initiate it. This SA node will, even without parasympathetic or sympathetic innervation, it will depolarize and reach threshold all by itself. Okay, and we call that the chronotropic effect on the heart. So anything that can adjust the heart rate, that's the chronotropic effect. And if it influences the strength of contraction, we call that an inotropic effect. So there are two things, and those effects, right, relate directly to this cardiac output equation right here, because heart rate is what? The chronotropic, and stroke volume is force of contraction. That's the inotropic aspect, and we have to look into both of these to know what the cardiac output is going to be. All right, so what's the relationship between cardiac output and stroke volume? Cardiac output and stroke volume, how would we talk about that? What's the relationship there? It is directly related. That's what I want you to know. Directly related. So if stroke volume goes up, what happens to cardiac output? It goes up as well. What's the relationship between cardiac output and heart rate? Okay, you've got two choices, either directly related or inversely related. But in this case, it is directly related, just like stroke volume. So if heart rate goes up, what happens to cardiac output? It goes up as well. All right, so you should be familiar with that. All right, so autonomic innervation of the SA node is a main controller of heart rate. Sympathetic and parasympathetic nerves modify the rate of spontaneous depolarizations. All right, sympathetic increase in sympathetic tone will increase heart rate, and increase in parasympathetic tone will decrease the heart rate. All right, so here we see some action potentials. All right, so these are in the heart. When you see these action potentials, you should be able to tell, is it a nodal cell or a contractile cell? So you should have an action potential in your mind, actually two different varieties of action potentials, one by a contractile cell and one by nodal tissue. This is from nodal tissue, because if it was a contractile cell, remember, the action potential has a long plateau region in it. We did talk about that. So this is from nodal tissue. And I guess that makes sense because we're talking about the pacemaker. All right, so norepinephrine and epinephrine stimulate opening of these pacemaker HCN channels that depolarizes the SA node faster, increasing the heart rate. All right, so here is just some spontaneous depolarizations under normal circumstances, but if we were to increase sympathetic tone, right, we would open up some HCN channels, which would then more quickly depolarize the membrane. We have a steeper slope right here, so it would reach threshold sooner, and that would cause an action potential. And then over here, because the slope is very steep, because those HCN channels are open, you would get another action potential from the SA node very rapidly. All right, so that's how you should understand regulation or chronotropy on the heart. And the reverse of that, for instance, acetylcholine promotes the opening of potassium channels. And what can you tell me about potassium channels when they open up? Yeah, they hyperpolarize, right? So when a positive charge leaves the cell, then that hyperpolarizes the membrane. And so that counteracts the influx of sodium from those HCN channels. All right, so when those potassium channels open up, it takes longer to get to threshold because it has a hyperpolarizing effect. Right, and in the same period of time, we have one action potential under parasympathetic stimulation compared to what, three action potentials in that same period of time, because the slope of this generator potential right here changes depending on the balance of sympathetic and parasympathetic activity. All right, so I'm sure this is an exam figure. Okay, let's talk about the other component in cardiac output. Oh, what's cardiac output once again? How do we call it? What do we use to calculate cardiac output? Stroke volume and heart rate. Good. All right, so we are kind of done talking about heart rate. So let's talk about the contractility or force of contraction. That is the inotropy of the heart. The cardiac control center, I call it the cardioregulatory center in the medulla, coordinates the activity of the whole autonomic nervous system. Right, and there are sympathetic nerves that go to the atria and the ventricles. And when we have neurotransmitter released from these sympathetic nerve endings, it increases the force of contraction of the muscle cells of the atria and the ventricles. Right, so these epinephrine and norepinephrine will have a positive inotropic effect. It will make the heart contract faster. So in terms of that equation, cardiac output, which variable is going to be adjusted or manipulated when we change the sympathetic tone to the heart? Okay, yeah, stroke volume, that's right. When we talk about contractility, it's not heart rate, right? That's a chronotropic effect, but if it's an inotropic effect, it's going to have an effect on the stroke volume. All right, so here's a pretty interesting table, and we see different regions of the heart, like some nodal tissues, SA node, AV node, and atrial muscle and ventricular muscle, and then we have the effects of the two divisions of the autonomic nervous system. And one thing that you notice right away is that sympathetic nerves go to the SA node. So it can influence the SA node, goes to the AV node, it can influence the AV node, and atrial and ventricular muscle. So sympathetic stimulation can influence all of these different places within the heart. But if we look at the parasympathetic nervous system, Where does the vagus nerve go? Okay, does it go to atrial muscle? No. Does it go to ventricular muscle? It does not. All right, so the parasympathetic nervous system only goes to nodal tissues, thereby it can only affect the chronotropy of the heart, not the inotropy. Parasympathetic nervous system doesn't control the force of contraction, only the rate of contraction. And it decreases the rate of contraction. And what's the effect on cardiac output when that happens? If the rate decreases, what happens to cardiac output? What's the relationship between cardiac output and heart rate? Directly related. If one goes down, the other goes down, right? Or if heart rate goes down and we hold stroke volume the same, then blood flow decreases as well. All right, so this is a pretty good table to make sure that you understand the difference between the chronotropic effects on the heart and what parts of the heart are responsible for that and what can influence the inotropy of the heart and what nervous system and where does it go. So it's a pretty nice table. All right, so stroke volume. Some of these concepts aren't really intuitive, but maybe when we talk about it, it will make some sense. The stroke volume, or another way of thinking of stroke volume, is the strength of contraction. Right, or contractility. Sometimes when we say contractility, we're actually talking about the strength of contraction. Right, and what part of what effect is that going to be? Is that going to be an inotropic effect or a chronotropic effect when we manipulate stroke volume? Inotropic, because it's the force of contraction or contractility. Right, so there are some variables that influence the stroke volume, and if it influences stroke volume, ultimately it's going to affect cardiac output, right? Because that's what we use to calculate cardiac output. Sounds like I just faded away. Oh well. Okay, well here are the three variables. I'll just speak up. There's end-diastolic volume, EDV. And you know what that is? What is end-diastolic volume? That is the large volume of the ventricle at the end of diastole, and it's filled with blood. So at the end of diastole, the ventricles stretch out because blood is flowing into them. So that's the first thing. And we're going to see that it's directly related. Stroke volume is directly related under most circumstances to end diastolic volume, and we'll see why that is. Total peripheral resistance is the impedance to blood flow out of the arteries. Right, so one way to think of this, if we increase the impedance, then the cardiac output should go down. And we have a nice equation to look at that. That's just the blood pressure equation. And myocardial contractility is the strength of ventricular contraction. Right, myocardial contractility and end-diastolic volume are almost the same variable, almost the same. Okay, but nonetheless, they're directly related to each other. The end-diastolic volume determines the workload on the heart before it contracts. So we call that the preload on the heart. I think that was part of the diagram that you have to draw in lab today. All right, stroke volume is directly related to preload and contractility. So that if end-diastolic volume or the preload increases, what happens to stroke volume under most circumstances if it's directly related? Yeah, it increases. Okay, that's kind of a funny concept. Usually if you think if you increase the load, that you might decrease the stroke volume, but that's not true in terms of end-diastolic volume. We'll see that is. Okay, so here is kind of the same statement, but the strength of contraction varies, what, directly with end-diastolic volume or how much the ventricles are stretched out when blood flows into them. Total peripheral resistance, on the other hand, we don't call that the preload, but that's the afterload on the heart, and that impedes ejection from the ventricle. All right, so resistance in the blood circuit is important because we're going to see that blood flow or cardiac output is related to the pressure divided by the resistance. So resistance or total peripheral resistance decreases cardiac output. Here is a concept that we just throw in right here. We don't talk about it much in this class, but this is a very important index on how the heart is functioning. It's called the ejection fraction, right? The ejection fraction is just the amount of blood that is pumped out of the heart, okay, when it contracts compared to all of the blood that was in the heart before it contracted, which is the end-diastolic volume. And there's no ventricle that can pump out 100% of the blood that fills up the ventricle. There's always going to be some residual volume inside the heart. And the healthier the heart is, the bigger the ejection fraction is. And if somebody's ejection fraction is decreasing, normally is about 60, that's pretty good. But if it gets down to 40, okay, we know we have a sick heart, 30, when it gets down in the 20 or below 20, okay, a patient is probably in cardiac failure, and there might not be much we can do for that patient at that point in time. Okay, so clinically, we don't like to talk about these irreversible things that happen to somebody. We also always like to think of positive treatments that we can do to make somebody better, but in some circumstances, when somebody's in cardiac failure, we just can't reverse that condition. Okay, and that can be determined by the ejection fraction. Somebody might also have a leaky valve, right? And a leaky valve eventually will kill the heart, and the ejection fraction will be monitored over a period of time to see if it's decreasing. And so ejection fraction can be used to time when surgery is performed on various patients, when you track it over time. Okay, so that ejection fraction is a really useful tool, clinical tool, to understand how somebody's heart is functioning, at least in terms of its inotropy. All right, so here is something really interesting. This is the Frank Starling law of the heart, and we sort of talked about this in terms of skeletal muscle. You'll see why probably on the next slide. But here is a plot of stroke volume versus end-diastolic volume of a ventricle. And it says as the end-diastolic volume of the ventricle increases, right, as that EDV increases, the heart stretches out more, what happens to contractility of the heart or the stroke volume? It goes up. Yeah, so it's directly related. There's a little curvature to these graphs. That's okay. But basically, they're directly related to each other, right? When end-diastolic volume increases, under these conditions right here, stroke volume increases. The heart gets stronger. And this is just an intrinsic property of the heart. It has nothing to do with any reflex activity or hormones or innervation or anything. It's just a property of the heart or a property of a sarcomere, tell you the truth. And what kind of muscles have sarcomeres? Skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle, right? So both skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle will obey this law, right? But the other thing that this says, as end-diastolic volume decreases, what happens to contractility of the heart? It decreases, right, because it's directly related. All right, so this is good and bad. It's a double-edged sword. The Frank Starling law makes it obvious to us that when more blood flows back to the heart gets stronger so that it can do what? So it can pump more blood. So that is really fortunate. The heart kind of automatically adjusts for the preload. Right, but the bad thing about this, all right, what happens to end-diastolic volume if somebody gets in an accident and they lacerate an artery and they start to hemorrhage? Okay, what happens just because of that hemorrhage? Okay, so instead of blood going back to your heart and filling up the heart, maintaining end-diastolic volume, right, that blood is running out of your body, can't flow back to the heart, so end-diastolic volume decreases. And what happens to that patient's heart? It gets weaker, right? And the more blood they lose, the weaker that heart gets, which is not what we like to see. All right, so we need to replace those fluids in that patient immediately.
Is that when the heart rate goes up because it's trying to get the blood back?
Yeah, it's trying to maintain cardiac output. Okay, so stroke volume goes way down. And your body is trying to maintain cardiac output. The only way it can is to increase heart rate because of that cardiac output equation. That's really nice. So this is what we call the ascending limb of the Frank Starling law of the heart. Okay. There's also a descending limb, which we'll look at in just a little bit. But let's look at why it is so. So here I see one, two, three, four different cases of what? What do we got over here where I have the cursor kind of winging around? What is that thing? That is a sarcomere, right? You see thin filaments and thick filaments, actin and myosin, and they interdigitate with each other. And here is a Z-disc, and here's a Z-disc over here. And this sarcomere, okay, when do we find a sarcomere in this condition? At end-diastolic volume or end-systolic volume? Yeah, in systolic, when there's no blood in the ventricle, right, or very little blood in the ventricle is not stretched, so all the sarcomeres are contracted like this, right? And we know, right, that in order for that muscle to produce tension, what has to happen between actin and myosin? Yeah, they form cross bridges and they have to slide over each other. But when the sarcomere is shortened like this, the Z-disc can't get any closer together because why? The myosin bumps right up against the Z-disc, and it can't shorten. So when a muscle fiber is in this condition, it can produce very little tension, right? It can produce very little force. So a condition over here is this A curve on the graph of tension versus time. And we see that that is the least amount of tension that this myocardial cell can produce because it's not stretched out. All right, so let's stretch out that sarcomere. And what happens to force of contraction in B? Is B greater tension or less tension compared to A? It's greater tension, okay? And what about C, where we stretch out the sarcomere a little bit more? All right, but we still have plenty of overlap between actin and myosin, but now the sarcomere can even shorten a little bit more, producing more tension. So here is curve number C. And then finally, here we have an optimal length of this sarcomere, which is what we find around end-diastolic volume, which means that there's still sufficient overlap between actin and myosin, but this is the condition where the sarcomere can shorten the most, and when it can shorten the most, that produces the most tension, and we see that on this curve over here, curve number D. So this just shows you that as the end-diastolic volume increases, what happens to tension produced by the heart? Or contractility or force, it increases, right? Which is what we saw on this diagram right here. Okay. All right. So, what do I want to show you about that Frank Starling law? Okay. Here's your book. I'm surprised the book doesn't talk about it in a little bit more detail. All right. So, what do we have over here? We've got contractility. Okay. So, we'll put stroke volume. And over here, we're going to put end-diastolic volume, right, which is the stretching of the heart. And remember we said as the heart stretches, it gets stronger. So here's that Frank Starling curve. The heart is getting stronger and stronger and stronger. Okay, but now, let's go back to the next slide. Go back to the next slide. Sounds like a movie. Okay, so here's a sarcomere. And so now, let's increase that end-diastolic volume some more. And so what's going to happen to the overlap between actin and myosin when we start to stretch it more? The overlap is going to decrease, right? And if we really stretch it, there won't be any overlap at all. And what about that sarcomere when there's very little overlap? It's useless. It can't produce any tension, right? So here we have the whole Frank Starling curve, right, like this. It's got an ascending limb and a descending limb. This over here is a condition when the heart is being too stretched out, the sarcomeres can't work. Okay, so that's the descending limb. So what can we do? So this right here, the ascending limb, let's just say somebody's in this normal condition here. Here's normal, right? And all of a sudden they start to hemorrhage, they lose blood. End diastolic volume goes down, their heart gets weaker, they go into cardiovascular shock. How can we help that patient? We can help that patient by increasing their end-diastolic volume by doing what? Forcing fluids into their vascular system, right? And as we force fluid, even saline solution, if we give to somebody, right, that's going to increase end-diastolic volume, doesn't even have to be blood, right? But if we even give somebody a salt solution when they're hemorrhaging, what happens to the contractility or stroke volume of their heart? It increases, right? So their heart function comes back, so that's really handy. All right, under this condition over here, the descending limb, this is, for instance, what might happen when somebody has a dilated cardiomyopathy. The heart is actually dilated. It usually happens because they've had uncontrolled blood pressure and other kinds of things, and the heart starts to dilate, especially the ventricles, and when it over-dilates, it gets weaker. Okay, so what can we do for a patient that's in congestive heart failure? All right, and when they're on this descending limb of the Frank Starling law, their end-diastolic volume is too big. How can we reduce the end-diastolic volume on somebody? Okay, yeah, we could, like, let some blood out of them, but there's a better way. Okay, they used to do that. How about give them a diuretic? Yeah, give them a diuretic, right, and they just urinate that volume, water volume, out of their body that decreases blood volume, that decreases end-diastolic volume, what happens to the strength of their heart? It's like a miracle drug, and under certain circumstances, certain patients, right, their heart function will come back almost immediately, okay? But they will be in the bathroom as their heart gets stronger. All right, so this is a really nice curve to appreciate, right, because it really describes what kind of therapies you might want to give a patient. Okay. So that's intrinsic control of the heart. That just has to do with a sarcomere. And these sarcomeres make up all of the myocardial cells. All right, let's talk about extrinsic control. We sort of talked about extrinsic control of contractility or stroke volume. All right, and that is going to involve the autonomic nervous system. And what can you tell me about the autonomic nervous system? How many divisions are there? There are two. But on that table, how many go to the muscle tissue itself, not the nodal tissue, because that's chronotropy. We're talking about contractility, which is what? An inotropic effect. Only the sympathetic nervous system, right? Only sympathetic nerve fibers go to the heart muscle itself. So this is why we're thinking about sympathoadrenal activity or sympathoadrenal tone in a person, right, will determine the end diastolic volume or the strength of contraction of a person's heart. Okay. So both norepinephrine and epinephrine, because these both come from the adrenal gland, for instance, norepinephrine comes from sympathetic nerve fibers, right, the postganglionic fibers, right, produce an increase in heart rate. We're not so concerned with that right now because we want to really think about what? Contractility, right, and contraction, right? So these sympathetic mediators will have a positive inotropic effect on the heart, which means that it will make the heart contract more strongly. And that's going to be due to just an increase calcium within the sarcomeres. So here we have a plot of tension versus muscle length, right? So we can think of the Frank Starling curve being plotted right here. These two lines represent cardiac muscle. This line over here represents skeletal muscle, just for fun. It was put on this diagram. But here are two conditions, these two curves of heart muscle. We see, okay, if when we go to 80% resting length, this condition over here produces very little tension, right? This curve over here at the same muscle length produces a lot more tension. All right, so what's the difference between these two curves besides the colors that I can't see? Okay, so one, okay, is cardiac muscle with epinephrine, all right, and then here's cardiac muscle without. So without epinephrine, where are we? We're way down over here at 80% length, and it produces maybe 7% of relative tension. Okay. But when there is epinephrine on board, we're on this curve, so when we're at 80% length of a muscle compared to normal resting condition, we are, what, 35%. So that just shows you that an increase in sympathoadrenal activity increases the force of contraction of the heart. Okay, even if we control for end diastolic volume. Okay, so sympathetic mediators increase the strength of the heart, no matter what the end diastolic volume is. So here is a really nice diagram. Of course, the one that you have to draw in lab is even more sophisticated. I like it. All right, but let's go over this one. You got cardiac output once again. Okay, is equal to, it's reversed. Heart rate, usually we have heart rate over here. I just noticed that. But we have heart rate, right, times stroke volume, all directly related to cardiac output. So what things influence the heart rate and what things influence stroke volume? That's just another way of saying what things have a chronotropic effect and what things have an inotropic effect on the heart. Okay. Okay, so we said that sympathetic nerves go both to the nodal tissue and the muscle tissue of the heart. So it will have an increase in heart rate and force of contraction. All right, so sympathetic tone increases the rate, that's a positive chronotropic effect, and increases contraction, that's a positive inotropic effect. All right, parasympathetic nerves, on the other hand, go where? To the heart. All over, like sympathetic nerves? No, only to nodal tissue, right? So it can influence chronotropy, but not inotropy, because it doesn't go to any muscles, right? So it can influence heart rate. All right, then we saw this Frank Starling law right here. We see that when end diastolic volume increases, right, the stretch of that ventricle increases, and then contractility of the heart increases, and when that happens, stroke volume increases. So over here we have positive inotropic effects, okay, and these are what? Just intrinsic properties due to the Frank Starling law, when we get optimal overlap of actin and myosin myofilaments. Okay, mean arterial pressure. All right, mean arterial pressure could be considered the resistance to blood flow being pumped out of the heart, because the ventricle has to overcome that pressure that's in, for instance, the aorta. Right? And on your diagram, where do we put afterload? At the top? Where? Yeah, right here. Okay, so that is afterload. And did I have preload on here? Preload. End diastolic volume. Right? Okay. Really good. All right, so this is a pretty handy diagram. Now, I forgot what the difference is between this dotted line and these solid lines right here. Solids is? Okay. Yeah. Okay, solid lines is excitatory on the heart, both chronotropy and inotropy. The dotted lines would be inhibition, right, due to parasympathetic nerves, for instance, or if you increase afterload. Okay, will decrease. So parasympathetic nerves decrease heart rate, mean arterial pressure decreases stroke volume because it increases the afterload on the heart. Okay, so we see how important end-diastolic volume is of the heart because it controls how strong the heart can contract. So we're very interested in end-diastolic volume. And end-diastolic volume relates to how much blood is being returned to the heart. We call that venous return. All right, so let's take a look at venous return. It's going to be dependent on blood volume and venous pressure. All right, if blood volume increases, for instance, think of your tire on your car, and you drive into a gas station, and you notice that there's something wrong with the tire on your car. It's not really holding up your vehicle. It's kind of flat. All right. So to increase the pressure in that tire, do you take air out or do you put air in? That seems really simple, but it's a really nice way to think of this. Yeah, you put more volume into the tire, right? That will increase the pressure inside that tire. And when we increase that pressure, we increase venous return. That's going to increase end-diastolic volume, which means the heart is going to contract more forcefully. So that's pretty important. So how can you increase blood volume? By decreasing urine volume, maintaining, conserving water, and conserving tissue fluid volume. And that can be done, you'll see how that's done with some hormones in your body. Okay, venous return, you also know, is regulated by the respiratory pump. As you take a breath in, you have negative pressure in your thorax. It doesn't only just suck air into your thorax, but it also sucks blood into your thorax from the periphery. And gee whiz, what do you have in your thorax that is right there ready to go to work? You have your heart. You have your heart, right? And so when you inhale like that, you're helping to return blood to the heart because you're decreasing the pressure around the heart. So you get negative intrathoracic pressure that increases venous return, which makes the heart stronger via what law? When you have more venous return, you have a bigger end-diastolic volume, the heart gets stronger. What is that law? Yeah, it's the Frank Starling law. But in particular, what? The ascending limb, not the descending limb. Okay, so if somebody's in heart failure, they're in that descending limb, and we don't want to increase the preload on the heart. We want to decrease in that particular case by what? Increasing urine volume by giving them a diuretic. All right. Venous pressure also influences venous return. Veins contain most of the blood in your vascular system, and we said that those vessels are highly compliant. That means with small changes in pressure, they can change their size, right? Like a balloon is much more compliant compared to your car tire. So when there is a small change in pressure in the venous system, that's going to dilate these blood vessels, but there's smooth muscle around those veins. So if we increase sympathetic activity to those veins, they're going to start to contract, okay? And then what happens? It returns that big volume of blood back to the vascular system, right? And so we call that venoconstriction. That increases venous pressure, that also increases venous return, and then by the Frank Starling law via end-diastolic volume, that increases the strength of contraction. All right, so venous return is pretty important, like cornerstone foundation for understanding contractility of the heart because of its effect on stroke volume via end-diastolic volume. Okay, but not only breathing helps blood return to the heart, there's something else too. Remember, we have the respiratory pump and also the skeletal muscle pump, right? Every time you contract a muscle in your body, it pressurizes a vein someplace, it acts like venoconstriction, right? And so it pressurizes that blood, and it's going to want to squirt back to the periphery and squirt back to the heart. But which way is it going to squirt if it's a normal, healthy vein? When we pressurize some segment of a vein, okay, it's going to go back to the heart because veins have little things that arteries don't have. They have special structures in their endothelium. That's right, they have valves. So when a muscle contracts, it can't push blood in veins back into the periphery because of those valves. It can only go in one direction, can only return back to the heart. All right, so the skeletal muscle pump increases venous return, increases end diastolic volume, and then increases the inotropy of the heart, or the contractility of the heart. Yeah.
So the venous
Okay, I'm not quite sure. Venous, this one right here.
Yeah.
Venous pressure. Well, you know, it's very little pressure all over the venous system. But for instance, when you contract a muscle, the pressure is going to go as a percentage up a lot in that vein. And then when you relax that muscle, the pressure is going to go back down. All right, so the pressure in your venous vascular system changes. So there's going to be parts that are high and parts that are low, and it kind of switches around depending on what muscles you use and also how you're breathing. So for instance, on inhalation, the pressure in a vein in your thorax is going to be very low compared to pressure in the periphery. When you exhale, the pressure increases, right? That's what forces air out of your lungs, but it also is going to have a tendency to force blood out of the veins that are in your thorax. But can, once blood gets into your thorax, can it leave? It can't because of valves in veins, right? As long as it's a healthy vein. If it's a dilated vein and the valve leaflets can't approximate each other and touch each other, then yeah, blood is just going to slosh back and forth in the vein, right? So that's a pretty dangerous condition. So, I don't know, I kind of talked around your question, but did it answer it enough for you to see what your question was? I don't know if I saw what your question was. It was good enough? Oh, okay. Okay. But remember, blood will only flow from one place to another because of a pressure gradient. Right? Blood is a fluid just like a gas. And think of diffusion. Molecules can diffuse in what direction? Passive, from high to low. That's right. Fluids can only flow from high pressure to low pressure. Okay, so somewhere along the line, the pressure in these veins have to increase, right? Or the pressure of where it's going has to decrease in order for blood to return to the heart. Okay, venous return. Oh, we talked about the capacitance already. Veins only have a pressure of maybe 10 millimeters of mercury. Here we see, what is this right here? I guess this is just volume of blood. All right, so small veins and venules hold most of the blood in your body. Your heart only contains maybe about 10%. Arteries about 10%. Okay, and so you can see, and capillaries very, very little. So it's mostly veins that are filled with blood compared to other vessels in your heart. And remember, these are the ones that have a lot of capacitance, so the volume of these vessels can be adjusted with the sympathetic nervous system. And when there's venoconstriction, then it can return all this blood that's just kind of sitting in a vein back to the circulatory system, back to the heart. Okay? And we know because of end diastolic volume, that increases force of contraction or stroke volume. All right, so we looked at end diastolic volume on the heart, right? And that's a real important regulator in terms of how the force of contraction is controlled. And one of the things that controls the volume of blood is just the volume of all fluids in your body, right? How much fluid you have in your interstitial space, how much fluid you have in plasma, and all these things relate to each other. And here are three hormones that determine blood volume. We'll see how they do that. And because they regulate blood volume, they're going to control blood pressure. All right, so here are three hormones. I think we've talked about some of these already, but not really in terms of their true physiologic sense in the body, but you have antidiuretic hormone. All right, and usually we give this an abbreviation. What do we give? What do we say about antidiuretic hormone? What did we call it before? ADH. And ADH has another name. Yeah, vasopressin, which is very much like vasoconstriction. Okay, so antidiuretic hormone means that it has an opposite effect on the kidneys compared to a diuretic. So it helps you conserve water, helps you conserve blood volume. All right, and then what's the effect on blood pressure when you conserve water in your body and conserve blood volume? That helps to maintain blood pressure. Okay, aldosterone is another one that works. That's a mineralocorticoid that works through regulation of sodium in your body or an electrolyte or the osmolality of blood. And then the third one is atrial natriuretic hormone. So where does atrial natriuretic hormone come from? We know where these hormones come from. What about ANH, atrial natriuretic hormone? Where does it come from? The hint is it tells you in the name. It comes from the atrium, and that's just part of a heart, right? So the heart, and this is a hormone, right? So the heart really is an endocrine gland because of that, all right? So you have to kind of adjust your thinking a little bit. All right, so what's the deal with atrial natriuretic hormone? So it's a hormone. It comes from the heart. What does this natriuretic mean? What have you heard of natrium? What's that?
Sodium.
Yeah, so here's a hormone, right, that adjusts the amount of sodium that the kidneys excrete, okay? That's what this uretic comes from. And when you excrete a lot of sodium, then the filtrate in your kidney increases because the osmolality increases, and so water will diffuse down its concentration gradient from plasma into filtrate and then excreted in urine. Okay, so I would like for you to know, after we talk about these, which of these three hormones are synergistic, right, which ones work together, and which ones are antagonistic to each other. And what would you guess? Would you guess that all of them are synergistic, or should there be a couple, or at least one, that's antagonistic to the other? Isn't that kind of futile, like you step up one stair and then step back down, step up, step back down, and you never go anywhere? Okay, but antagonism is wonderful in terms of a control system, right? Just like the autonomic nervous system, just like a biceps and triceps. So here is an example of an endocrine system showing antagonistic control, which means that it has precise control and balance over fluid volume in the body. All right, so here it is, vasopressin right here. Good, don't forget that, same thing. All right, so ADH, you know, comes from the posterior pituitary. When the hypothalamus monitors and recognizes that your body is becoming too salty, all right, so that you're not conserving water. So that's measured by these osmoreceptors, right? And under high osmolar conditions or high salt conditions, and that might be due to what? Maybe drinking too many margaritas with salted glasses, right? So ingesting too much salt. Not the alcohol part of it, all right? And when ADH is released, that causes, well, when these osmoreceptors are stimulated, since it's in your brain, you're going to have a sensation of thirst, right? And when that happens, of course, you're going to hopefully drink water and not a salty solution. And when you drink water, then that feeds back negatively to this high osmolality condition, right? And that brings you back into homeostasis. Right, and ADH also stimulates water resorption from urine, or actually a better way of saying this, it stimulates water resorption from filtrate, okay, which is that fluid that's the precursor to urine that a nephron produces. All right, and of course ADH is inhibited by low osmolality. So let's look at this flow diagram over here. The stimulus, right, could be dehydration. Okay, dehydration means you're losing water from your body, and when that happens, blood volume decreases, and maybe another stimulus is salt ingestion. Both of these effects right here are going to increase blood osmolality. It's going to become what? Too salty. Yeah, too salty. You want to think thick? That's okay. Okay. So when that happens, the receptors are in the hypothalamus, osmoreceptors, and since it's in your brain, it can give you the sensation of thirst. When that happens, you'll drink something, hopefully nice clean water. Right? And when you drink water, what happens to blood volume? It goes up. And what happens to osmolality? Well, you start to dilute all those salts in your body, so it goes down. And what is this response compared to the initial stimulus? It's negative, right? It subtracts. So that's a nice negative feedback loop. All right, that didn't include ADH, but let's throw ADH in there now. All right, so when the hypothalamus monitors high osmolality, all right, the hypothalamus controls what? The pituitary gland, and in particular the posterior pituitary, will release antidiuretic hormone. So that it's going to have, that hormone will have an effect of conserving water in your body. Right? And when the kidneys retain water, that increases blood volume, and when you retain water, that dilutes out that salt, and we call that what? Decreasing blood osmolality. So, and both of these effects feedback negatively to this initial stimulus right here. So this is a good mechanism for ADH for you to understand. Is this an exam figure? I can't remember. Ah, good. Okay. Who needs a little bit more description of this illustration? Okay. Pretty good. So that is ADH. Now what about blood pressure and ADH? Okay, what happens to blood pressure when blood volume increases? Okay, think about your car tire. When you, increase the volume of that car tire, you know what's happening to the pressure inside there. It's what? It's increasing. All right, so when you increase blood volume, you increase blood pressure, but you should also kind of understand why, because you're having more venous return when you have more blood volume. And because of the Frank-Starling law, the heart gets stronger and blood pressure increases. Okay, another effect of ADH that's not on this diagram right here, but relates to this name, vasopressin, it also causes vasoconstriction. And we talked about vasoconstriction, and in particular, venoconstriction. And what's the effect of blood pressure when there's venoconstriction or constriction of any kind of blood vessel? Yeah, think of a water balloon, and you squeeze down on it. What happens to the pressure in that water balloon? It goes up, right? When you decrease the volume, you squeeze and squeeze, and if you squeeze too much, what happens to that water balloon? Well, it bursts, right? And, of course, that can happen to patients that have uncontrolled hypertension, right? They can have aneurysms, right, that burst. All right, so ADH is a way of maintaining blood pressure, increasing blood pressure. That's where I was going with this, okay? Because it helps you retain fluid, and I think that's a good enough reason right there, because your body retains fluids. And so ADH, well, it also causes what? Constriction of blood vessels, which increases blood pressure. All right, so let's go on to this mineralocorticoid, aldosterone. Right, and it's a steroid hormone, and it's secreted by and synthesized by an organ. What organ synthesizes and releases aldosterone? It is the adrenal gland. And what part? You don't have to tell me the sublayer. I just would like to know the cortex. Yeah, the adrenal cortex. Okay. And again, aldosterone helps maintain blood volume, and because it maintains blood volume, it maintains blood pressure. And the way that it does that is that it goes to the kidney and it tells the kidney to resorb and retain salt as well as water from urine. So it kind of sort of almost has the same effect as antidiuretic hormone. All right. So it is stimulated by salt deprivation when somebody does not have salt in their diet, low blood volume, and low blood pressure. And so aldosterone is going to, what, reverse these trends right here through negative feedback mechanisms. All right, so ADH and aldosterone in terms of blood pressure do what? Increase or decrease blood pressure? ADH and aldosterone. Increase blood pressure. All right, and what's kind of a rampant disease, okay, for us? here in the United States. Hypertension, yeah, in relation to blood pressure. Hypertension, right? Blood pressure that's way too high. So we've seen some hormones, okay, two hormones, and their only effect is to increase blood pressure. So that probably might stimulate your interest to know something about those hormones, because they're responsible for, right, that hypertension that people are experiencing. All right, our last, oh no, we're going to talk about aldosterone a little bit more. Why does it have an effect on blood pressure the way it does? Okay, and we need to look at the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. Okay, and this is really important. I'm sure I have a couple exam figures in there, a number of multiple choice questions on your test. So let's look at this system right here. And the best way to understand it, I think, is to draw it out. And I'm going to talk about it a little bit, but make sure you can draw out the steps sometime on a blank piece of paper. Ooh, that should be another extra credit quiz, because it's important to know. All right, but when salt is low, right, you have low blood volume, or when you have low blood volume or pressure, low blood pressure, there is a compound that gets produced in your body. It's called angiotensin 2, which means that there is an angiotensin 1 as well, right? So angiotensin 1 has to be converted into angiotensin 2 before it becomes active, and angiotensin 2 causes vasoconstriction. What happens to blood pressure when there's vasoconstriction? It goes up. And what was the initial stimulus? Low blood pressure, right? Low blood pressure causes aldosterone secretion, and it causes the sensation of thirst, which, and all of these increase blood volume, which will increase blood pressure. All right, so let's look at this whole mechanism. Where did this renin come from? Well, we see aldosterone as a hormone. Let's look at some of these other things. Here it is right here. I wish I could make it a little bit bigger. Okay. So here we have low blood pressure. We have, because low blood pressure, we're going to have reduced blood flow to the kidneys. So this is where we're going to start, in the kidneys. And there's a special place right where the distal convoluted tubule passes by the afferent and efferent arterioles. It goes right between them. It's called a juxtaglomerular apparatus, okay, in the kidneys. All right, so when there's low blood pressure, that apparatus secretes renin into the blood, right? And renin is an enzyme. It's not a hormone, even though it ends up in the blood, but there's something waiting in the blood, okay, that renin can act on. There's something in blood that acts as a substrate for renin, and that is angiotensinogen. Right, and what could you tell me about a compound that's an ogen? It's inactive, but you have plenty of it in your body that can be converted into an active form to have a reasonable physiologic effect for you. Right, so you are producing angiotensinogen all the time. Angio means blood vessel or vessel. Angio just means vessel. Tension means what? The contraction of a blood vessel. Right, that's where it got its name from. So this compound from the kidney converts angiotensinogen into angiotensin 1. And then there is another enzyme found in primarily the lungs, which is angiotensin converting enzyme. And we just call that ACE. Right, but that's important to know because it converts angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2. Right, so ACE does that. Angiotensin 2, right, goes to the adrenal cortex, so that's an active hormone. Angiotensin 2 is an active hormone, goes to the adrenal cortex, causes secretion of aldosterone, and because that aldosterone increases salt and water retention by the kidneys, that increases blood pressure. So that's an effect of angiotensin 2. Okay, so angiotensin 2, because of this tension term right here, causes vasoconstriction of arterioles, and that also increases blood pressure, right? Okay, so the kidney is very important in maintaining blood pressure. And in this particular case, all right, in which direction does it work? By making it higher, right? And so this is actually the most important mechanism for long-term regulation of blood pressure in your body. Not minute to minute or day to day, but from, well, almost day to day, but week to week, month to month, okay, over a long period of time. So So this mechanism right here is what's responsible for producing hypertension in people. Because what do we know about all these things? It increases blood pressure. So we would like to make some adjustments right here. And what's the first line for somebody with hypertension? What's the first line of pharmaceuticals that we would give somebody? And that is a diuretic. Okay, reducing blood volume, that's going to reduce blood pressure. But your body's going to try to compensate with that one way or another and increase your blood pressure even though you're taking a diuretic. So guess what happens for people with hypertension? Usually they have to take two, maybe even three medications in order to get control of it, because your body, just through this mechanism right here, is always forcing that person into high blood pressure. Okay, so how could we disrupt this mechanism? Well, there are certain things called ACE inhibitors. Right, and an ACE inhibitor prevents the conversion of angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2, and then that just negates all of the effects, or it stops the effect of aldosterone in your body. Right, so that should reduce blood pressure. That works with some people, maybe by itself, but maybe in combination with a diuretic, an ACE inhibitor. Okay, here's another class of drugs, kind of new. These are ARBs, angiotensin 2 receptor blockers. Where do we have angiotensin 2 receptors at? So here we have angiotensin 2. You have receptors for angiotensin 2 where? In arterioles and in the adrenal cortex. And when we block these receptors, right, then we block high blood pressure because of venoconstriction, and we block the release of aldosterone. Okay, and so then you'll release more salt and water via the kidneys, right? So ARBs, angiotensin 2 receptor blockers, right? And beta blockers as well. Where do you have beta blockers? Or where do you have, what's beta referring to? An adrenergic receptor, so a receptor for norepinephrine or epinephrine, and particularly in the heart. Right, so these are neurotransmitters for the sympathetic nervous system, and when we block those receptors, we're kind of toning down the activity of the sympathetic nervous system on the heart. So we decrease the inotropy and chronotropy on the heart, and blood pressure decreases as a result of that. So that's another pretty good treatment for hypertension. Then there are calcium channel blockers. Right, not so. Beta blockers and calcium channel blockers don't directly relate to this diagram right here, but I thought I'd throw them in there because this is such an important disease process. Why would you think calcium channel blockers would have an effect on the heart and actually decrease its it would have a negative inotropic effect on the heart? Because calcium is that signal, right, that allows cross-bridge cycling to take place, and that calcium has to go through channels in the plasma membrane, has to go through channels in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So when you block those channels, not so much calcium can enter the sarcomere, and so then those sarcomeres won't contract with the same force. Right? So calcium channel blockers are great. We don't talk about alpha-2 agonists like clonidine. That's an adrenergic receptor. These are central receptors in the brain, right? And this is a very powerful drug. Most people can't tolerate clonidine. But for instance, if somebody comes into the emergency room, okay, with a blood pressure of like 200 over 100, what's normal blood pressure? Like 120 over 80, right? So if somebody has blood pressure 190, 200, something like that, okay, what could happen to them at any second? Yeah, they could blow up a blood vessel, right? And so you would like to decrease that blood pressure immediately, and clonidine is a really good drug for doing that. Okay. So have an immediate and really nice effect on reducing blood pressure. So here is the renin-angiotensin mechanism. All right, so you see the kidney is real important for regulating blood pressure, because it can secrete renin, which converts angiotensinogen into angiotensin 1. And then there's an enzyme ACE in another organ, namely the liver, which converts 1 into angiotensin 2. And angiotensin 2 can stimulate the release of aldosterone and cause venoconstriction, which then increases blood pressure. So This is the most important mechanism for long-term regulation of blood pressure in your body. And people are always thinking of ways to tweak this mechanism to help people with hypertension. And here are a couple ways that we do that. Okay, I didn't mention any drugs in particular, but you might want to look up some trade names or generic names of a diuretic or an ACE inhibitor or an ARB or even a calcium channel blocker. You probably might know of some of those already. Oh, here's a website for something. How about that? Okay, so we talked about two hormones. We got to talk about one more. But let's recap. We talked about ADH and aldosterone. What's the effect of blood pressure, right? If we increase ADH and increase aldosterone, what's going to happen to blood pressure? It's going to increase. So what might be your guess is the effect of atrial natriuretic hormone on blood pressure? Well, we'd like to see something antagonistic, right, in your body, hopefully to maintain blood pressure in a normal range. Right, I call this atrial natriuretic hormone. Your book calls it peptide. Probably hormone is a little bit more universal, but I don't care what you call it. Okay. Expanded blood volume is detected, right, when you have expanded blood volume. You get more venous return. So the end diastolic volume increases, but not only in the ventricle, but in the atria as well. So the atria start to stretch. And there are stretch receptors in the left atrium. And the left atrium then releases a hormone, atrial natriuretic hormone, when it starts to stretch. And atrial natriuretic hormone inhibits aldosterone. All right, so what's the effect when aldosterone is inhibited? It reduces blood pressure, right? Atrial natriuretic hormone promotes salt and water excretion. So when you lose water in your body, your blood volume decreases. What happens to blood pressure when blood volume decreases? It decreases as well. And it promotes vasodilation. Okay, when blood vessels vasodilate, the pressure in them decreases. All right, so atrial natriuretic hormone has the opposite effect. It's antagonistic to both aldosterone and ADH, or vasopressin. All right, so that's where the antagonism comes into. So that's a really important process. So, in terms of blood pressure, both atrial natriuretic hormone, so that we see that the heart really is an endocrine gland as well, at least the atria, because they secrete atrial natriuretic hormone. So that, together with decreased ADH, acts in a negative feedback mechanism to lower blood volume and then, of course, blood pressure. All right, so I don't know if this is an exam figure or not. I thought maybe it was too simple to be an exam figure. But I think we should talk about it anyway. Okay. So when you have increased blood volume, right, you have more volume of blood in your body, so there's increased venous return. When you have more blood returning to an atrium, what happens to its physical size? It starts to stretch. And remember, there's stretch receptors in the left atrium, and then the left atrium will secrete atrial natriuretic hormone, which is this branch right over here. Natriuretic hormone goes to the kidney, and it causes the kidney to resorb salt and water from filtrate. Right, and so that's returned to the body. That increases salt and water excretion. Atrial natriuretic. Yeah, it increases. Right, so it's like a diuretic. It's a uretic compound. Increases sodium and water excretion by the kidney. Right, and when you lose water in your body, by increasing urine volume, that decreases the blood volume. And that's going to decrease venous return when that happens. Right, so the initial stimulus was increase venous return, but in this particular response, it's going to decrease venous return, so that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. Okay, so atrial natriuretic hormone causes salt and water loss because there are receptors in the kidney for that particular compound coming from the left atrium. All right, these stretch receptors are also hooked up to some nerves, namely the vagus nerve. So this is an afferent division of the vagus nerve. It carries information to the brain. And the brain then can influence the posterior pituitary, right, via the hypothalamus, and it decreases the secretion of antidiuretic hormone, right? And so that enhances the effect of atrial natriuretic hormone, which is what? A diuretic. So if you cut back on an antidiuretic while giving somebody a diuretic, that increases urine volume and decreasing blood pressure. Okay, let's talk about some other factors affecting blood flow. What's another way of thinking about blood flow? We had an equation that talked about blood flow. What was that equation? Flow, blood flow, and especially the heart. There was an equation that described blood flow through the heart or leaving the heart, which was cardiac output. The cardiac output is just blood flow through the heart. And how could you calculate cardiac output? What do you need to know? Heart rate and stroke volume of the heart, right? Those two parameters. All right, so that's for the heart, blood flow through the heart. Okay, we're going to look at vascular resistance as well. Okay, so vascular resistance determines how much blood flows through a tissue or an organ. All right, so if you have an organ on my right-hand side, where the resistance decreases while an organ on my left-hand side increases, then more blood is going to go to the organ on my right-hand side because it has lower resistance, okay, if we keep the pressure the same. And vasodilation decreases resistance and increases blood flow when there's vasodilation in, like, an organ on my right-hand side. Vasoconstriction is going to have the opposite effect. It increases resistance and decreases blood flow. Here's just a table that shows you about what percent of cardiac output goes to various organ systems in your body, and you can see, like, the top three would be the gastrointestinal tract, right, for absorption of nutrients, and the kidneys. These really small organs have almost 20% of your cardiac output. That's one-fifth of the job of what your heart is doing, okay, is taken up by the kidneys, because the kidneys are producing urine all the time. They have to be doing that. And then skeletal muscles. And I'm just always kind of shocked to see that only 13% goes to our brains because it's so highly metabolically active, but still not compared to other things in our body. Okay. All right, so we're going to get into a couple more equations right here. So we know cardiac output is equal to stroke volume times heart rate. That's a blood flow. Okay, and here we have another way of thinking about blood flow, not through the heart, but through the vascular system, right? Blood flows through the vascular system when there is a pressure difference, right? So blood will flow from high pressure to low pressure, and it's directly related to the pressure difference, all right? So blood flow is directly related to the difference in pressure from an artery compared to what you have in a vein. Or maybe a way of thinking about it, maybe the left ventricle compared to the pressure that you have in the right atrium. That completes the circuit right there. All right, so what is the difference in pressure for this systemic circulation? Well, we know that normally we have a blood pressure of 120 over 80. Okay, if that's normal, that's what, systolic over diastolic? Because your blood pressure fluctuates depending on whether the heart's in systole or diastole, but we just want to know what the average pressure is. And if we look at that waveform and calculate what the average pressure is, it's 100 millimeters of mercury. If we take all the pulsatile nature out of it, it's just 100 millimeters of mercury. And then over here at the right atrium, or even in the vena cava, the blood pressure is zero. So what's the pressure difference? It is 100 minus 0, or 100 millimeters of mercury. That's a pressure. That's the force that's driving blood through the systemic circulation under normal conditions. We're going to call that delta P, right? So delta P is just a difference in pressure on two ends of this vascular system. Okay. And you've done some calculations with this in lab. All right, so here's the equation that you should just memorize. Flow is equal to the pressure, right, difference, but one of the pressures is zero, so you could just consider that the pressure of the arterial system. So it's pressure, right, and how is pressure related to flow? How would you describe that really simply to somebody? directly related. Increased pressure, increased flow through these blood vessels. All right, but there's something else you have to consider, and that is the resistance to flow. And what's the relationship between flow and resistance? Inversely related. So if you increase resistance, what happens to flow? It decreases. All right, so these are the two parameters that are going to affect flow through a blood vessel. Okay, but we know resistance has a number of different components in order to understand resistance. Resistance is directly related to the length of a blood vessel. So the longer the vessel is, what can you tell me about resistance if it's directly related? If we make a blood vessel longer, what happens to resistance? It goes up, okay? And when that goes up, of course, flow is going to go down. It's inversely related to the radius of that blood vessel, okay? So that means when, if it's inversely related, it means that since this is in the denominator over here, resistance is going to go down, right? Because resistance is inversely related to radius. So when radius increases, what happens to resistance? It decreases, right? And don't forget, resistance is inversely related to flow. So when resistance decreases, what happens to flow? It increases. Okay. So it's, I think, really handy to think of it in that term. But here is something that's really important. It just doesn't scale exactly how the radius changes. It has an effect on your body to the fourth power rule, which means when you have a small change in radius, okay, it's going to have what kind of effect on the resistance and then on that blood flow? A small change, you have to multiply itself four times, okay? So a small change in radius is going to make a huge change in resistance, which makes a huge change in blood flow. All right, so what can you, I forgot to mention viscosity, which is the thickness of blood, all right? So if you make blood thicker, what's going to happen to resistance? It's going to increase, right? Okay. All right, so what is a good way for your body to adjust blood flow? Does it change the length of a blood vessel? No, typically it does not do that. So that's not any way that we can adjust blood flow. What about the viscosity of blood? Maybe a little bit if somebody becomes hypovolemic, right? Or if somebody's taking EPO to perform better in sports activities, like somebody just been accused of doping, and that increases red blood cell, it increases hematocrit, and of course if you increase hematocrit, then you think you might have more oxygen delivery to tissues because you have more red blood cells, but what happens to viscosity of the blood when you start to jam a whole lot more red blood cells in there? Then it gets thicker, right? And the viscosity increases. So I'm not sure that's a really good way to enhance your performance for athletics, but some people do it. So the only way that your body can adjust blood flow is by adjusting the radius of a blood vessel by vasodilation or vasoconstriction. And that's going to have a really powerful effect on resistance, which then will have an effect on blood flow. All right, so here is that equation, Poiseuille's law. So flow, we got blood flow over here, we got the pressure difference, which is right over here, and then we have the resistance term, which is all of this stuff. We got the length of a blood vessel, we got the viscosity, and then here's the radius to the fourth power, right? And really, this radius right here should be what? The denominator of this term. But the denominator of this term could be what? The numerator of this whole thing. So that's why we put radius to the fourth power right here. So if we increase the radius, this is nice to look at, if we increase the radius of a blood vessel, what happens to blood flow? Increases, because you see here it's directly related to it, okay? And in a very powerful way because of that fourth power exponent right there. Okay, so that is nice. But here is a good basic equation that I would like for you to know. All right. Flow is equal to pressure divided by the resistance, or it's resisted by the resistance. That's where that term came from. All right, so here is a plot of blood pressure versus various segments of the cardiovascular system. Here we see the left ventricle. And what can you tell me about blood pressure in the left ventricle? How does it vary? It goes high to low, But in particular, it goes all the way to zero. When does that happen? When the heart is during diastole. When the ventricles are relaxing, it can't produce any pressure, so blood pressure in that ventricle goes to zero. And then during systole, right, it jumps way up to 120, and then that aortic semilunar valve opens up, and so that it allows the heart to actually pump blood into the arterial system. All right, so there is a huge variation in blood pressure in the left ventricle, and we see that it is really the highest blood pressure, okay, in the left ventricle, 120. Large arteries like the aorta, their blood pressure never goes to zero like the ventricle does, right? It dies away much more slowly, and it doesn't go to zero because the heart goes into systole once again before it goes to zero. So the blood pressure in arteries fluctuates between 120 and about 80, right? Usually when it gets down to 80 at that period of time, what happens? The heart contracts again, and it shoots back up to 120, right? So this is a nice blood pressure to have, nice normal blood pressure. When we get to arterioles and arteries, we see that there is a big drop in blood pressure, okay, like from 100 over here to like 35, right? And that's because this is where we have the most resistance in blood vessels, right? These arterioles are small in radius, and you have some, okay, but not as many compared to capillaries. You have many more capillaries than you do arterioles. Right, and so, of course, you know exchange takes place in capillaries. You don't have as much resistance in a capillary, so you don't have as much a decrease in blood pressure across a capillary. And then in veins, that's where we lose the last amount of blood pressure in these capacitance vessels. All right, so what could I ask you here? What vessels, when you look at this diagram, have the lowest blood pressure? Okay, and without looking at this diagram, probably including me, when I first started to look at physiology, I would say a capillary, because that's where exchange takes place, right? That's kind of where all the action takes place, is in a capillary. But does a capillary have the lowest blood pressure? No. The lowest blood pressure is found in large veins. Let's ignore the zero over here in a ventricle, because it's just changing too much, right? Because if capillaries had the lowest pressure, what would happen to blood? Blood would flow into capillaries. Blood would flow into capillaries from veins. Forget about that they have valves. And blood would flow into capillaries from arteries. And it would have no place to go. So these capillaries would get bigger and bigger and bigger, and then we just burst into a big ball of hemorrhage all over the place, right? So capillaries don't have the lowest pressure. Veins do. All right, so I think I'm going to start next time here describing these graphs, and then we're going to talk about some blood pressure. This is kind of a mysterious slide. You might want to look at this slide before next time to try to figure out why blood pressure is controlled by heart rate, stroke volume. I think that's pretty obvious because that's both cardiac output. But what about peripheral resistance? How can you think about peripheral resistance affecting blood pressure? Okay, and next time I'll show you how to see that very easily and nicely. We got an announcement here. Oh, don't leave. An announcement. Da-da-da-da-da.
That was a lot of information, and I know a lot is really important, so I just recommend coming on Wednesday if you can to SI. So we'll go over a lot of that stuff.
Yes. Excellent. So one question you might get in SI is, what's the most important long-term regulation mechanism for blood pressure? The renin, angiotensin, aldosterone mechanism. Right, so I don't know, draw that out a couple times.